Hello there, this is Mike Knezovich, and welcome to the latest edition of Tune Up with Mike and Monty, Thinking and Feeling Good. We're here in Chicago this morning with the esteemed Dr. Monty Pavaluri. Doctor, how are you?
I'm great, thank you, Mike, and I'm excited to be talking about some special topic today.
Each episode we talk about how our brains function and what goes wrong sometimes and what we can do about what goes wrong. It's basically demystifying all this brain science. Today we're going to talk about something called cognitive flexibility domain, or CF domain, and that's a pretty technical term, but let's start at the start, and maybe you can give us a straight definition of it, Dr. Pavaluri.
Sure, let's go about this step by step, okay? So cognitive flexibility basically is a capacity to be aware of alternative options, what you're thinking alternatively, and how you can respond differently when you are facing the choices and when you need to transition from one activity to the other, or one belief system to the other, or one response to the other. So it's basically a flexibility or ability to be flexible and modifying how you want to respond in situations that face you on a daily basis. You know, sometimes it is to do with changing your internal cues that direct you when those cues meet this demands and your circumstances and situation around you. You have to cull them together in a certain direction. So it's a capacity to recruit lots of parts of your brain. But then there is a certain system that works to help us switch or shift from one way of doing to the other, or one way of thinking to the other. So in real life, to just make it simple in the lay terms, Mike, it's like not being rigid and stuck and being able to be sort of be flexible.
Yeah. So it seems like it's the intersection of a lot of functionality, but can you talk about these things are always like, okay, there are certain things that are related specifically to a kind of a part of the brain or a circuit, and then there are the other things it touches. And if you can sort of make that distinction.
Sure. Before I do that, I just want to make it very clear that the simple real life situations are very often coming across us all the time. I mean, they confront us all the time. Say, for example, if my husband says, let's do salad for lunch today, and I might think, oh, wow, this is getting old, you know, something I made yesterday, like a casserole. So why don't we finish it off? But then if he feels like salad, then it's really nice and important for me to be flexible. Plus, it's to be eaten anyway, what we have. So to be able to shift from thinking one way to another way to meet what he wants is a simple daily thing that we do.
That we always do.
We always do. So to be able to go with the flow with your partner or with your children.
Or at work.
Or work. You know, when you're in a meeting, you know, somebody asks you, you know, do you mind teaching this class at this time and change it with me? And you might say, oh, no, I have patients booked at the time. I don't want to change. But then you think that you really need to work and change, and this could happen if I shift some things and make it work for that person. So you really figure out a way to make things happen in a flexible way. So this is something that confronts us on an everyday basis. But however, in a very rigid situations like an autism, for example, where the kids are a bit more rigid, or even without autism, for example, some kids have rigid way of thinking with their brain and without other features of autism, and they want to wear only certain clothes, they want to wear only certain shoes, they don't want to eat certain foods, and they're very rigid in the way they think, and that makes it very hard for families. So it's a matter of helping families to understand cognitive inflexibility that is so important to demystify and help them to work through it, you know. So this is what I'm talking about. It has a huge spectrum of what we do on a daily basis to extreme rigidity where it becomes dysfunctional in daily life. So we want to understand what happens when you're inflexible in the brain, and what are the other aspects in the brain that impact it.
Yeah. And again, it's one of these things where this one-track mindedness that you're talking about, We can tend to sort of consider it a character flaw, but it can be just a malfunctioning of this circuit. And it's not a it's not something that we should judge each other on. It's something we should understand.
Sure, definitely. And I think it's a biological issue. A lot of us have a little bit of rigidity when we were young. Say, for example, I used to insist that my dad taught my math problems only in a certain way that my teacher taught me. So these are the kinds of things that all kids can get into as well. So, but it develops with time. So some of the milder ones can change with time, and some of the difficult ones won't change with time. So what happens in the brain? We already talked in several podcasts about different aspects of the brain, but as a standalone, I would like to describe some few things. Mm-hmm. In the front of the brain, there is an area called prefrontal cortex, mm-hmm. and that has problem-solving area and where the Mickey Mouse ears are. But between that, between those problem-solving areas to other small, of course, brain works in problem solving, pulls in zillions of other aspects within the brain. But what I'm talking about for quick and dirty purpose is that there are these crucial areas called dorsolateral prefrontal cortex that helps in problem solving. And those areas are connected to areas called basal ganglia. And the basal ganglia are like frontline soldiers at the bottom of the brain called subcortical parts, below the cortex, So these subcortical basal ganglia structures are very critical for shifting, learning, as well as shifting from one thing to the other. And they learn to shift, yeah? And that switch from one decision to the other, one choice to the other, happens with the help of this basal ganglia, okay? So the basal ganglia, what is very tricky and interesting is between this prefrontal cortex and basal ganglia, there is an intermediary structure called anterior cingulate cortex. That really helps in error, switch connection, and everything. So that middle structure, anterior cingulate, is it has a little circuit or a loop around it. The ACC is connected to prefrontal cortex and subcortical basal ganglia, and the circuit that projects from this anterior cingulate called ACC to basal ganglia and to the gateway of the brain called thalamus and then back to the ACC is very critical in the switching and catching errors and missing what they need to catch, etc. This anterior cingulate circuit was described in a review by Cummings in 1993, and we still hold this circuit as very critical in switching in when you are choosing things, and this area could be impaired along with several other domains in the brain. To sum it, it's dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the anterior cingulate cortex, which is intermediary cortex, and the basal ganglia. And also there is an area called posterior cingulate cortex, which is at the back of the brain, exactly on the opposite to the ACC or anterior cingulate, the intermediary part. That's also responsible for attention and storage of information and kind of like switching. So the ACC and the posterior cingulate work in tandem along with the basal ganglia.
Woo! There's a lot going on there. It's like a switchboard.
Yeah, it is, exactly. So like a switchboard with the circuits helping
you. It seems to affect a lot of functions. I mean, it requires paying attention, mm-hmm. memory. Decision-making to some extent.
Absolutely. The scientists Onen and Kosak in 2015 have examined high school students, in fact, to examine what is behind their feeling of success, motivation, and sense of worth. And if they do hold a positive attitude and have a feeling of success, what is central to it that makes it tick is cognitive flexibility. Mm. And what is fascinating is it's only possible to be flexible if the knowledge is well organized in the mind. In other words, you know, you should have a capacity to have good working memory, good executive function, reasonable vocabulary, and being able to inhibit responses in time to do the right thing, and also understand what goes on in other people's minds and take a perspective of others, you know?
So this is we're talking about something that pulls all those things together.
All those things together in addition to emotion regulation.
Yeah. So
that's a lot, right?
That is a lot, but I'm wondering when, to the extent that it's a question of it's biological, or it's a question of development or a lack of development or something, how do you recognize this? When do you recognize it? You know, how does it develop in a person that is what we call average or normal?
Oh, in an average and normal, you know, you can, even in average normal people, they could be glimpses of cognitive inflexibility as they grow up,
yes.
You know.
Who, me?
Yeah.
No.
That's right. You know, we all have that a little bit. But what happens is that it develops, and, you know, the good thing is actually cognitive flexibility is teachable and changeable through development, although some stubborn traits remain. Or problems remain in those who are affected. So, for example, by 1 year, the children can sort objects, but only by shape, say.
Okay.
You know, and, and one way of learning. Because by one, in fact, they don't know the colors. They only know the colors by, you know, like, you know, after three, between three and five.
Okay.
You know? So they can change from working on one dimension to shift to another dimension, such as sorting from based on shape to color could be very well developed by five, you know.
Okay.
So the some of this work is published by Peek and Weishart in 2015, who did the experiments on very young children and published very, very credible literature. By seven, they can actually attempt to work with multifaceted sorting.
Okay.
They use a test called Wisconsin card sorting test, where it uses all the front part of the brain, where you switch from one way of sorting to another way in multiple ways.
Okay.
By nine, in fact, they can sort color, shape, quantity all at the same time, you know, together, instead of switching from one facet to the other. Here they could switch together at the same time using those rules. There is a question of say, pick the red one that is a rectangle and three of them, you know, they would be able to do that and switch into something else. So
the complexity of what they can do is growing
with time. And what is fascinating is there is a test called Stroop test, where there are colored words, blue, yellow, purple, black. And then if you write the blue in a yellow color and then the yellow color in red, you should be able to shift and pick up very swiftly if you're supposed to say the color or the spell, the lettering. And adults tend to be a bit more sensitive than developing children and even adolescents, for that matter. The nuance of being able to shift is well developed in adults. And I think, and it's actually, there's evidence that white matter tracts and being all our, you know, brain circuits being insulated properly with the white matter as the nerve signals go up and down have some role to play. And the white matter tracts keep on developing until late 20s.
Okay.
You know, I mean, early 20s to mid 20s at least. You know, they keep on developing. So naturally, the adults have a better way to solve some of these problems using Stroop test anyway. And one important point to really understand is that the Stroop test may not always completely translate to everyday flexibility, such as changing choices, you know, and learning how to adjust.
Okay. So like all tests, it has some limitations.
Some limitations.
So kids growing up, what environmental factors are there? I mean, in terms of parenting approach or, you know, what encourages this domain's development?
Oh, as a clinician that could work with specific domains at any one time, garnering what is published in the literature and how we can understand it while I am still trialing it, you
okay.
know, it really is something to do with our own experience in helping the families.
Okay.
We roughly know how to teach them to be less rigid by introducing choices very early on.
Okay.
Some of these cliches of introducing and widening choices, being compassionate, helping them with affect regulation as they're learning, one-to-one teaching, kindness while you teach, and all of these are very important. But what is very critical when you're treating these kids is working with parents with extreme care into the nuances of how they communicate with their children while they teach.
Okay.
It's almost like when a young child a 11-year-old might want to bake a cookie first thing in the morning for breakfast, and the parents might, in traditional sense of with their intuition of wanting to help the young woman to grow into, you know, more, you know, thoughtful in what she should eat for breakfast, they would say, be careful with, you know, you need to eat enough fruits and vegetables, you know, fruits and mm-hmm. healthy food and for breakfast than cookies. But what we can also help them to meet is, what are the other choices that you could make for yourself? And is there any way I can help, you know, you could do it differently maybe tomorrow, yeah? But and then also praise them and meet them where they're at for their effort to have baked the cookies, and move forward from there rather than pick up a bit of a fight through
instead of guiding them in a straightforward manner. Instead of a flat out no, that's a bad idea.
You want to do that.
Okay.
So some of those are very important. And beyond that, I think the kids can learn cognitive flexibility through some proven evidence-based techniques such as hypertexting. For example, kids can open a computer, get into a link, and then they go to think about, like, say, a certain botanical plants. Then they would go on to another information link through that link, and then they go on to something else, like knowing all the plants in that group, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be able to go from one link to the other, gather information, cut paste, and then synthesize this information and create your own story about what you're going to do, like a project.
Okay.
So that's sort of like going back and forth through multiple resources of information on computer could expand the repertoire of thinking and being flexible and shifting, like shifting the channels of the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And that is found to be very helpful by Stevens and Campbell in 1995. They published that literature, very old now, but still good, holds true. And then the cognitive behavioral techniques are really good, coping with unexpected situation, how they shift in belief system. Say, for example, how they face bad news, transition through problem solving. They're all kind of very useful.
So the CBT would just kind of teach them.
What would you do in this situation? You
run
could
them,
ask them.
Run them through and yeah. and coach them through.
Yeah. Also, you could say, what could I do in
right.
that situation? I think the most important thing in teaching flexibility is the adults verbalizing how they're making choices on a daily basis. Not
providing
necessarily
examples.
When they're in a conflict, but in general, teaching them you know, how they kind of face discomfort and move forward, or how they make choices based on their internal thinking, how they organize their thoughts. Those are all very important, I think.
Okay.
Sometimes that may not be enough, but it's there are many little things that matter.
Are there medical solutions for this, or maybe used in tandem with CBT?
Right. I mean, there is a medication called citalopram that was tested in autism spectrum disorder children. With a case report was written with two cases that fMRI changes were seen in these two youth with the medication.
The fMRI being the functional MRI, the thing where you're in real time, you're looking at what's going on in the brain,
in
right?
the brain, before medication and after medication,
okay.
and after treating for a while. And they've shown that there are changes, and they do refer to the anterior cingulate being variably impacted in these patients.
Wow.
And it's normalized after treatment. So in that one example or illustration, one out of the two cases, where things didn't get better, it didn't change the anterior cingulate. So it activation. So it's very important bit by bit to pull information together to understand as the science is beginning to expand in this area.
Mm-hmm. Like everything else, it's moving fast. So
exactly.
It could look different 12 months from now.
I know. And the other thing that's kind of cool and interesting, I stopped my son from playing like these shooting games like Call of Duty and that and this on Xbox forever. I mean, of course he plays once in a while, but I think that, you kind of like moderate this. But in elderly, apparently, something like this, like first-person shooting games could really help them to kind of make decisions and move forward and increase their cognitive capacity to be flexible.
You mean like...
And Colzato and colleagues wrote in 2010.
Like Call of Duty kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's like one study. I mean,
But
it's just...
so I imagine people, senior citizens do these shooting games.
Exactly, right? Well, how weird is that? I think we have to be very careful with these brain-based training using
various... I was about to ask you, they're everywhere now. Like this thing like Stay Sharp. And, there's the whole thing about doing crossword puzzles, which I do, which is fine. But then there are these things that you can sign up for and pay for that are supposed to be like exercises for mental acuity. Is there anything to that?
There is a problem with, providing evidence. The reason for that is that you need large population and you need to execute these various interventions. It takes thousands of hours in repetitive activity of a certain kind where the cognitive flexibility is practiced.
Okay.
And retest them later and translate it to real life. It's almost next to...
That's enormous.
It's next to impossible, but although it can be done and it should be done. And people make claims such as in Lumosity and learning treatment. So Fair Trade Commission took them to court and brought upon some lawsuits for claiming brain training to white patient populations without evidence such as that I was talking about. And I think that this is a problem. That said, some brain exercises in some form is always good.
It probably won't hurt.
It won't hurt, yeah.
It's just that
is a problem, is a stretch. Perhaps, But that said, I think keeping the mind sharp, teaching our children to learn wider ways of learning, to adapt, be flexible, these are all very important.
The simple thing that I kind of take away here is, at least for parents, is that you just explain and make transparent how you made a decision, a complex decision, and you're just providing examples, and that that
and
is real
positive,
basic.
And be positive when you're talking.
And
help them to envision what they could be doing and how they could be very good at it.
Yeah.
And that could open up some doors to doing well. So. That guiding them through it, through positive connectivity with their children and helping them to think through other people's feelings when they make the choices, make them excited about making good choices.
Yeah.
It's a style.
You know, if it's as complicated as all this is, that is really a very kind of simple, but probably simple to understand, but probably as a parent, I got to stop and think about that and remember to do it that way.
Right. And we can even use like roll with the punches.
Yeah, yeah.
Go with the flow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as always, I learned a lot. I hope everybody listening did too. And until the next episode, I'll see you, Moni.
Thank you so much, Mike, for asking me all these nice questions to kind of get me going on talking about this. And I so appreciate being able to work on understanding brain step by step.
All right. See you, Moni.